This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
This is Alex Smith, and I have a problem. Important news continues to pour out of the damaged Fukushima Daiichi plant in Japan, along with radiation reaching my home here on the west coast of North America. And it's going over all the way to Europe and even to North Africa and the Middle East. At the same time, about a dozen listeners have sent email reminders. This nuclear accident, even at its very worst, can never kill as many millions of people as climate change. Though Fukushima radiation may continue to damage the chromosomes of plants and animals for up to 1 million years, global warming appears to be driving a mass extinction event. Certainly, unless there is an explosion of every volcano on Earth to bring cooling, our greenhouse gas emissions have triggered a warming event which will last at least 100,000 years. American scientist David Archer calls it the long thaw. It might not take that long if the permafrost melts in the Arctic tundra, releasing all that methane, and that has started, or frozen methane under the sea is released. Nobody knows what a sudden shift in greenhouse gases could do. Top scientists like Dr. James Hansen or Michael Oppenheimer wonder if Earth has any brakes on a rapid greenhouse breakout. Is it possible this planet could lose its protective atmosphere to become like Mars? Even now, climate change is responsible for 300,000 deaths a year, according to a 2009 report by the Global Humanitarian Forum headed by Kofi Annan. Extreme weather and heat-driven climate disruption affected 325 million people. By 2030, that will double to 660 million people and 500,000 deaths a year, they predict. The United Nations also reported that the majority of people who lost their lives in disasters in 2009, three-quarters of the fatalities were climate-related. As horrible as Fukushima is, we can't take our eyes off the biggest problem. Climate change endangers our civilization, our species, and all species far beyond what the nuclear power and weapons industry can dish out. Perhaps it is good news that due to the economic recession, greenhouse gas emissions in most industrialized countries fell in 2009. The United States dropped 6.1%, or about 6.6 billion tons of carbon dioxide equivalent. That's the biggest change in American emissions since 1990. The second largest industrialized greenhouse gas polluter, Russia, announced a drop of 3.2% in 2009. Other countries reporting lower emissions to the UN Climate Change Secretariat for 2009 include Australia, Italy, Spain, and France, although Australia has started to go up again this year. Unfortunately, these reductions are likely more than offset by growing emissions from developing countries like China, India, Indonesia, and Brazil, and more. When it comes to loading up the atmosphere, polluting less is like saying someone is raping women less. What really matters is the climate continues to be disrupted and the total load is still increasing rapidly, and that's what matters. That guarantees a hotter and less stable world.
Yep, there goes the roof off a house. And
it's hard to believe the American media make no connection between historic tornadoes and storms killing at least 43 people in mid-April and the instability of the hotter atmosphere, which carries more moisture. The same media is not reporting the continuing radiation falling on the country from Fukushima either. But first, I want to refocus our minds on the biggest single threat to us all, despite the nuclear horror news. On April 9th, I recorded a new speech by Bill McKibben, the founder of 350.org, and one of the premier spokespeople for the American climate movement. I'm going to presume you know who Bill McKibben is. He wrote the first book about global warming, The End of Nature, in 1989. His latest book, which I highly recommend, is Earth, where the name of this newly changed planet is spelt with two A's. Perhaps you've heard a speech by Bill on the way the 350.org climate protests were organized to become what, quote, Foreign Policy magazine called the largest ever global coordinated rally of any kind, with 5,200 simultaneous demonstrations in 181 countries, and I'm ending that quote from 350.org. But now I want you to hear some new material from Bill McKibben. We'll start with his update on our climate situation 1 year after the publication of the book Earth. Then I'm going to skip over his story about forming 350.org and the first demonstrations. Don't worry, I'll give you a way to listen to the whole speech and the question and answer period as a free MP3 download from our website, ecoshock.org. It will be on our climate change page. We're going to skip ahead in the speech to some things that I haven't heard. The situation in China, bungee jumping from dead coal plants, the failure of international negotiations, and the disinformation campaign from the fossil fuel lobby. McKibben calls for a campaign against the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and against the Canadian tar sands. He talks about the theme for this year's big worldwide demo coming September 24th and why we have to try, even though we may have waited too long. This speech was recorded by Alex Smith at the University of British Columbia, April 9th, courtesy of the Vancouver Institute. Here is the short introduction by the Honorable Madam Justice Mary Newbery, followed by the new big picture on climate change by Bill McKibben.
Well, as Peter said, this is the last lecture of the 95th year of free public lectures at the Vancouver Institute. Tonight, our series will end on a high note with the Irving K. Barber Center Lecture. Professor Bill McKibben is an American environmentalist and writer. He is one of the founders of Step It Up, a grassroots environmental campaign to demand action on global warming by the U.S. Congress. He is also the head of 350.org, an international environmental organization focused on uniting the world around solutions to the climate crisis. Professor McKibben grew up in the suburbs of Lexington, Massachusetts. After completing his undergrad work at Harvard, he joined the New Yorker as a staff writer. After spending several years with the magazine, he quit when its longtime editor, William Shawn, was forced out of his job in the late 80s and moved to the Adirondack Mountains of upstate New York. He has continued to contribute to a number of publications, including the New York Times, the Atlantic Monthly, Harper's, the National Geographic, Rolling Stone, and Outside. His first book, The End of Nature, was published in 1989. It is widely regarded as the first book to warn the general public about the threat of climate change. Since then, he has written a number of books relating to man's relationship with the natural world. In The Comforting Whirlwind, God, Job, and the Scale of Creation, published in 1994, he uses the biblical story of Job to comment on modern society's hubris and neglect of the environment. In Deep Economy, The Wealth of Communities and the Durable Future, published in 2007, he addresses the shortcomings of the growth economy and envisions a transition to more local-scale enterprise. In his most recent book, Earth, with two A's, Making a Life on a Tough New Planet, he takes the position that we have already passed the tipping point for dramatic climate change. The world in which we have flourished for most of human history is gone. It is my pleasure to introduce Professor McKibben, who will be speaking to us about survival on a rapidly changing planet. Thank you.
Peter, thank you so much for having me here. I've been looking forward to this for a long time. It's a great pleasure for me to be here. It may be more of a pleasure for me than for you. I feel particularly in sort of, I've actually had a wonderful day here in Vancouver and ended with a beautiful hike up, where were we? Up West Canyon and down East Canyon, and then a visit into the incredibly beautiful Nitobe Garden. Is that what it's called? The Asian garden under the cherry blossoms and your tree. It makes me feel even worse than usual about my role as a kind of professional bummer-outer of people. I apologize in advance to you for my remarks tonight. And I'll try to end on a relatively hopeful note, but we are going to go through the valley for a moment first, because, look, climate change is by far the biggest thing that human beings have ever done. By far, and it's worth, though you know the outlines of it, just to be reminded every once in a while of exactly where we are and exactly what the implications are. I did write the first book for a general audience about climate change back in 1989, so I guess 22 years ago now. We knew most of what we needed to know 22 years ago. We knew that when you burn coal and gas and oil, you put carbon into the atmosphere. And we knew that the molecular structure of CO2 trapped heat that would otherwise radiate back out to space. The only thing we didn't know was how quickly this was going to pinch and how hard. And the story of the last two decades is it's pinching a lot faster and a lot harder than we had thought, even in our gloomiest preoccupations. That's what this last book with the strange title was about. And I won't bother listing at infinite end the proofs adduced in that book, the first chapter of which, I warn you, if you read it, is grim, tough going. It's a kind of series of sharp uppercuts demonstrating just how powerfully we've managed to knock most of the world's physical systems off kilter, things that 20 years ago we didn't imagine were even possibilities, like changing the chemistry of seawater, lowering its pH, turning it 30% more acid simply because it's absorbing so much CO2 from the atmosphere. I could list these for a very long time, trust me. I'm not going to. I'll just talk about what's happened in the years since that book came out, because the last 12 months provide illustration enough of precisely what's going on. 2010 was the warmest year for which we have records. 19 nations set new all-time temperature records last year. Some of those records were extreme. I was telling people yesterday about talking to our 350.org colleagues in Pakistan in June one day. We were just on the phone making plans, and one of them said, "It's very hot here today." And I was surprised to hear him say it. It's usually hot in Pakistan in June. No one would remark. He said, "No, it's really hot. We just set the new all-time Asia temperature record. It was 129 degrees Fahrenheit. Okay. When you have heat like that, all kinds of things happen. You're privy to some of it as you look north in Canada. The Arctic has continued its precipitous melt. Sometimes I think it's such an enormous effect that it's almost hard for us to see it simply because of its size. Go back and find one of those pictures that came back from Apollo 8. You remember those first pictures of the Earth as viewed from outer space 40 years ago. Those were beautiful pictures, and they are as out of date as my high school yearbook photo, you know. There is about 40% less sea ice in the Arctic than there was then. That's an astonishing change in a basic physical parameter. Last year was the year of perhaps the greatest melt yet. Both the Northwest and Northeast passages were open. People had a yacht race around territory that even 10 years ago we thought no human would ever navigate. And of course, the effects of that on the surrounding land are enormous as that tundra begins to thaw and the methane beneath it begins to leak into the atmosphere, and as one of the great ecosystems of the entire world begins to unravel. In fact, more than begins, unravels with astonishing speed. Across the world, in Russia, last summer they had a heat wave of epic proportion. It had never reached 100 degrees in Moscow. It was above 100 degrees for 8 straight days in the beginning of August, and that was enough not only to cause enormous forest fires and peat bog fires, it was enough to really scare the Kremlin. Their drought was severe enough that they decided to stop all grain export to the rest of the world. Russia's the third biggest grain exporter on the planet. Within weeks, the price of grain around the world had gone up about 70%, which means that there are lots and lots and lots of people tonight not eating anywhere near as much as they would like to be eating for dinner because they can't afford it. Maybe the thing that became clearest last year and sort of scariest of all was just how massively we've managed to screw up the hydrological cycle, the way that water moves around the planet. The physics of this are quite simple. Warm air holds more water vapor than cold. Okay? Therefore, The Earth's atmosphere is 4 or 5%, about 4.5% moister than it was 40 years ago on average. That's an astonishingly large change in a very basic parameter of the Earth. One of the first things you'd want to know if you arrived at a different planet, you know, one of the first things that if, you know, Mr. Spock had arrived on a new planet with what it was, tricorder or whatever he called it, you know, to find out what was going on this new amount of water vapor in the atmosphere is pretty basic. Well, there's a lot more of it, which loads the dice for deluge and downpour and flood. And now, year after year, but especially last year, the dice are beginning to come up snake eyes for place after place after place. You saw those pictures recently of the huge floods in Queensland. Similar things in the last few months in Sri Lanka, in Vietnam, in the part of Brazil northeast of Rio. Most powerfully last year in Pakistan. That country up and around the Khyber Pass, which normally sees about 3 feet of rain in a year, saw 12 feet of rain in a week. That swelled the Indus River so much that before it had completely drained, a quarter of the country was underwater. There are still 4 million people homeless in Pakistan as a result. Almost unbelievable to watch. And one of the things to bear in mind, and this is something I may repeat in the course of the evening, one of the things to bear in mind is nobody in Pakistan did a darn thing to cause that problem. There's an almost inverse relationship between how quickly you're being damaged by climate change and how much of the trouble you're responsible for. So it is not only a practical issue of the highest order, it is a moral issue and an ethical challenge of the highest order. It's also a very basic, practical survival issue for all of us because the scientists assure us that it's going to get worse. So far, human beings have raised the temperature of the planet about 1 degree. We've added about 3/4 of a watt per square meter of the Earth's surface of extra solar energy. That's been enough to cause the changes that we've so far seen. There's probably about another degree Celsius in the pipeline from carbon we've already emitted. It takes a while for it to fully express that heat in the atmosphere because the oceans hold it for a while. But we're thinking there's another degree already in the pipeline. What the climatologists tell us is, unless we get our act together very quickly, and by getting our act together, I mean ceasing to burn coal and gas and oil far more quickly than governments or economic actors at the moment are planning to do it. Unless we get our act together very, very quickly in the next few years, the climatologists are robust in their consensus that 1 and 2 degrees will be 4 or 5 degrees before the century is out, taking us way beyond not just anything we've known in human history. We're already probably past that, but to temperatures much higher than any time before the beginning of primate evolution, a completely different planet. If 1 degree melts the Arctic, we do not want to find out what 4 degrees will do. Everything that we can predict about it is deadly, including the fact that our main crops on which we survive don't do well when the temperature gets markedly higher than it is now. They've evolved for this world too. The new data from Stanford and the University of Washington would indicate that we could expect reductions in grain yields of 40 or 50% if the temperature goes up 4 or 5 degrees. That alone would be enough to make the world, the civilizations that we've built on it, impossible. For 10,000 years, we've built civilizations in a time of benign stability, what a period that scientists call the Holocene. We've managed in very short order to bring the Holocene to an end. The only question now is how chaotic and how crazy the world to come will be, and it depends entirely on how swiftly and bravely we move to do something about that problem. And something big, not something around the edges, but a central transformation of our energy economy. Okay, we're through the worst, and you can take a breath and apologize.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. You are listening to a speech I recorded at the University of British Columbia, Canada, with author, journalist, and climate activist Bill McKibben. You can download the full speech from April 9th, 2011, along with the Q&A as free MP3 files from our website at ecoshock.org. Look for our audio on demand menu right on the main page and choose climate change. In this broadcast, we are going to skip ahead to further updates by McKibben since he published his book Earth last year and after last year's successful 350 demonstrations all over the world. We'll now hear about everything from support by the religious community to pushback from fossil fuel billionaires and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and why we have to keep on trying to limit climate change despite difficult odds. Here again is Bill McKibben.
Of religious communities, really for the first time in something like this. We'd had good luck with prelates of all kinds. In fact, one of the things that made our organizing go really well across a large swath of the world was that 2 weeks beforehand, the patriarch of the Eastern Orthodox Church, Bartholomew, leader of 400 million Eastern Christians, and as it turns out, a fairly plain-spoken patriarch, had given a sermon in which he said, and I quote, "Global warming is a sin and 350 is an act of redemption." That helped. That's the head of Muslim South Africa, the head of kind of native traditions. Behind them, Archbishop Tutu's successor is the Anglican Archbishop of South Africa at the head of a huge multi-faith march. It's a Pentecostal school someplace. That's the most important evangelical college in the U.S. where Billy Graham went to school. Even a few years ago, there would not have been an environmental. They would have been viewed as sort of suspiciously pagan or something. It's a very good sign that it's now moved well into those communities, and they've become some of the best backers of this work any place in the world. I'd been to Bethlehem to do a little organizing. The Dead Sea is shrinking very dramatically as the planet warms. People there wanted to do something, but it's not an easy place to organize because there's military checkpoints and walls and everything all over the place. So the Jordanians said, okay, we'll do the three on our shore. Palestinians said, we're good for the five in Palestine. The Israelis said, we'll make the zero. It was really, really beautiful. And it was a sort of good sign of people putting aside some of their other differences, you know, for a little while to concentrate on those problems that unite us. We did a lot of that kind of global scale scrabble everywhere, and we had lots of fun, and it was everywhere, including here. And I'm really grateful to the people who helped us in Vancouver and Victoria and all sorts of other places do really, and I wish I'd found the pictures to put them in, but they're easy to find. I showed this picture yesterday, and I'll tell the story just because I like it. These in Soweto, a heartland of resistance to apartheid, they did 350 bungee jumps. But they sent us a note saying, we strung the line between the cooling towers of a defunct coal-fired power plant. This is the highest and best use for coal-fired power going forward. You know. That's my daughter is in the middle of that. Those are sap buckets because we're losing our maple forest pretty fast. 300 big demonstrations across China. Now, one of them did get busted up by the police, but the other 290-some went off. That's the China Youth Climate Network, and behind them, they're making a human wind turbine. If you look closely, you can see the world's largest wind farm in Inner Mongolia. Big help from all over the world, from unlikely places. That was the smallest demonstration and one of the most beautiful. She started out with a ton of her friends, and they had to go through about 6 U.S. military checkpoints, and not surprisingly, most of them got scared eventually and left. But she wanted to go on Ola to the side of the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, and she's just great. She's one of my... We brought her to Copenhagen later, and fantastic. The Maldives... If there's any country in the world that's engaged in this fight, it's the Maldives, a paradisical country in the Indian Ocean, entirely Muslim, incredibly beautiful. Highest point in the 1,200 island archipelago is about 1.5 meters above sea level. Okay? Their Student Government Association held this meeting in the lagoon to demonstrate their plight. The government itself, led by its wonderful president, Mohammed Nasheed, He trained all his cabinet to scuba dive so that they could hold an underwater cabinet meeting on their dying coral reef and pass this resolution to send to the UN demanding action on this 350 target. Okay? And they're not just doing political action. This not very rich country has announced that it will be the first entirely carbon neutral nation in the world by 2020. And they are putting up windmills and things just as fast as possibly they can from one end to the other. It should shame us to some degree to watch this happening in places like that. Just a magnificent day of all kinds. We took over Times Square and flashed thousands of these pictures on those big jumbotrons that are normally advertising vodka and things. And it was great. We wanted to show the New York media. We also wanted to take pictures of those pictures and send them back to people in the Congo and say, look, this is what you look like 50 feet tall, and you are a big part of a big movement. It got extraordinary media coverage. It was the lead story on Google News for about 36 hours because there were more sources linking to it of new newspapers and TV coverage and stuff than any topic on the planet. And I think the biggest reason was just because support was coming from such unlikely places and from people to who our eyes do not look like environmentalists. Those guys, you know, those are some oil-rich sheikhs in their oil-rich sheikhdom, but they're smart oil-rich sheikhs. Behind them is the edge of the world's largest solar array, you know. They're figuring out what's up and what's coming. Mostly just these vast things happening in places we had never heard of. And there were also, I confess, a large portfolio of slides grouped together in a file called 350 Adorable. And they really were adorable. And they're also really painful to look at. There were a lot of refugees in the last bloody century we just came through. But you couldn't tell in 1911, you couldn't say who the refugees were going to be 40 years hence, you know. You couldn't predict how history was going to go. You can predict with some accuracy that those girls will be refugees by the time they're in middle age. No fault of their own. I wish I could tell you that all this had carried the day. It obviously didn't. We got to Copenhagen 6 weeks later with a lot of momentum. That was really good. We convinced 117 nations to sign on to this 350 target. That was pretty good. We were, you know, I mean, we started with 7 college kids and no money, and that we felt 170 was good. The trouble is, of course, they were the wrong 117. They were the poorest nations in the planet, the richest and most addicted, led by the countries of North America, refused to do a damn thing. Wouldn't bite the bullet, wouldn't take any action, did everything they could figure out how to do to walk away from it. And so that meeting collapsed. 6 months later, the U.S. Senate refused to even take a vote on the most tepid and moderate and tame of climate bills. I was worried this whole movement would just kind of collapse in despair. It hasn't, happily. We had another big day of action last October, and it turned out to be bigger than this one. We did a global work party. This time people were building things, solar panels, bike paths, community gardens. It was pretty great. There were 7,400 of these work parties in 189 countries, every country on Earth but North Korea. It was grand. And still, of course, not enough, not anywhere near enough. We're just beginning to figure out how we're going to do this. There'll be another one of these global days of action this year, and we need your help. It'll be on September 24th. Circle it on your calendar. Go to 350.org for more information. It'll be beautiful. It'll be based around motion. And there'll be people on bicycles in places all over the world. Other things too, but a lot of bikes, because bikes are one of those few tools that both rich and poor on this planet use, you know. But we're under no illusions that that is enough. What's become clear over the last few years is that the goal, the technique that we're going to use to win this isn't what we thought it was. It isn't enough merely to provide our leaders with information about what's going wrong and how they might solve it. They know that by now, and they're doing nothing. And the reason that they're doing nothing is because of the financial might of the fossil fuel industry, which has been enough to stall any kind of progress. And when I say financial might, I mean it. This is the human activity that has produced more money than any other, is the discovery, refinement, and combustion of fossil fuels. ExxonMobil made more money last year than any company in the history of money. Okay? In our political systems, especially in the United States, a little bit of money like that is enough to stall action for a long time. And that's what they've achieved. And until we can take them on, we're going to lose. So we're trying to be a little tougher. We're having a big campaign across the United States this year to take on the single most powerful lobby in the United States that's blocking action. It's a group called the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Okay? It's not like your local Chamber of Commerce. Those are my town. The local Chamber of Commerce supervises the Chili Festival. They do an excellent job at it. Okay? We like them. The U.S. Chamber of Commerce isn't like that. It claims to speak for all American business, and in fact, they have these foreign subsidiaries, the American Chamber of Commerce in Thailand or China, and I think in Canada as well. They claim to speak for all businesses, but in fact, 55% of their budget came from 16 companies. Now, they don't have to tell anybody who those companies are, but it's darn easy to figure out who they must be, because their main legislative agenda is making sure that the planet warms up as fast as it possibly can. They've lobbied against every even modest attempt to do anything, and they've done it in the most strident terms. Last year, they filed a brief with the Environmental Protection Agency saying that they should not regulate carbon because in the event that the planet did warm, humans would be able to adapt their behavior and physiology in order to deal with the warmer planet. Not that their 16 blessed companies should adapt their business plan to a world that ran on sun and wind, but that all human beings for all time should adapt their physiology to deal with this problem. It's unclear to me even what they have in mind, you know, grow gills. I don't know. But it's crazy. And if someone came up to you on the street in Vancouver and told you that their plan for dealing with global warming was that you would adapt your physiology, you would step around them in the street and go on. But if they had $200 million in their back pocket, you know, then it might be enough to persuade you, if you were a political leader, to think and do otherwise. And that's what's happening. And it's, I'm afraid, not only what's happening in America, but though I understand the situation less perfectly here, I think to some degree it must be what's happening in Canada as well. Now, I'm going to apologize in advance right here, because I'm going to speak frankly. In the way that sometimes people who are leaving town the next day can speak frankly, okay? I have an enormous love for Canada. I spent my elementary school years in Toronto. That's where I went to school. And moving back to the States after 4 or 5 years was in many ways a great shock. And I've always kept in the back of my mind my memories of Canada and contrasted its deep and strong community ties, it's somewhat less individualistic culture, it's quite remarkable institutions, kept them in my mind as a kind of reminder of what's possible and of many of the ways that the U.S. had gone off the rails. And so it is really painful to look north and see Canada behaving in really damaging, really dangerous ways. The confluence of things that are happening in Canada right now, and some of them in British Columbia, the endless fracking for natural gas so that you can send it to the tar sands to allow them to cook up those tar sands so they can get them liquid and put them in a pipeline and send them back to British Columbia and put them on a tanker and send them someplace to get burnt. There is no more effective way in the world to produce carbon emissions than that. The tar sands have become the single great source of carbon emissions, or one of them, in the entire world. There's enough carbon in there to warm the planet a degree, perhaps, all by itself. And now, the increasing willingness to take not only Canada's coal reserves, but also perhaps to build the infrastructure to let the coal, enormous coal reserves in Montana and Wyoming, make their way here to the ports to be sent to Asia, you're becoming drug dealers of the most dangerous substance on the planet right now. And the fact that it's happening more or less without much debate and controversy, I mean, I know that there are plenty of you who are working hard on this. I've spent the last couple of days with great activists led by my friend Seth Klein at the Center for Policy Alternatives and learning all kinds of stuff about what people are doing. But I also opened the newspaper today and read the stories about the election saying that these things aren't even issues, that people aren't really raising them, that they're not important to Canada's electorate. This is, more than anything that's happened in the history of Canada, going to be its legacy to the rest of the world and to the rest of history. If you pour that carbon into the atmosphere, there is no way that we can balance the atmospheric books and keep the temperature at a place that it's possible to work. And so we really, really, really need you getting involved. And I want to go say one more thing that might sound the tiniest bit rude. And I don't mean it to, because you've done an amazing job on this, in this city and on this campus, of making it a real showpiece in a lot of ways. There are great things happening. There are beautiful, efficient buildings. And Vancouver has done remarkable things. That's good. Keep doing it. But don't spend all your time gilding the lily and perfecting every last thing here, because this isn't a problem that we can solve one place at a time. I wish it were. If it were, I would stay home in Vermont, where I love, and I would happily watch what y'all were doing in this neat place. But you know what? You can build the best local agricultural system that the world's ever seen in British Columbia, and if it doesn't rain for 30 days, or it rains every day for 30 days, you won't grow anything. You can't escape the world here. So take some of that energy that's being poured into all these great and wonderful and beautiful things, and also use it to engage nationally and internationally with this problem. Join in fights like 350.org so that you can leverage some of that energy beyond Vancouver to join in with the rest of the world. That sounds so, I don't mean at all to sound harsh, and I say it only because I know that this is one of those places where people do have the will and the empathy to get to work and to make an enormous, enormous difference. It's been my privilege the last few years to just go around and around the world spewing carbon behind me, there is no doubt. Talking to people, helping people organize, get going on all of this, and always for me, an incredible privilege always to be in a room in the Maldives or in Ethiopia or in Peru or something with people who are doing this work and who are willing to do it in this global, even though it's not their fault, even though it's not their problem, even though they could just as easily just be angry at the rest of us. Instead, they've chosen this kind of path of some kind of solidarity. It's always a privilege. It's a great privilege for me to be here tonight. Great honor to be here tonight with those of you who are doing this work already and with those of you who I hope will do it in the future. I cannot promise you that we are going to win. There are scientists who think that we have waited too long to get started, and there are political scientists who think the odds are simply too high and the power on the other side too great, and they may be right. If you are a betting person, you might be right to bet that we would lose, but you're not allowed to make that bet. The only moral position for someone alive at the moment when the worst thing that happened is happening is to try and do something to change those odds some. So I look forward just to working shoulder to shoulder with you in the years ahead to see what we can do. No guarantee of victory, only that we will fight hard all the way through. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you. This is Radio EcoShock. That concludes our selections from a speech by author and activist Bill McKibben in Vancouver on April 9th. Now we're going to get some fresh perspectives as Bill answers questions from the audience. Things like climate and agriculture, population growth, and the role of civil disobedience. But first, some fellow in the front named Alex Smith asks about climate change now that Fukushima appears to have blown up the nuclear power option.
How does the Japanese nuclear accident in Fukushima change our picture for our energy future and what we can do about climate change?
So how does the accident in Japan and the nuclear thing change the parameters of this fight? I think not. My guess is not too much, because I don't think nuclear was ever going to be an enormous part of this solution, not so much on safety reasons, mostly because it's an unbelievably expensive way to produce power. It only happens when you give big subsidies. Most places aren't going to do that. There's only in a few countries like China are we going to see really large-scale development of nuclear power in the next 30 or 40 years. I think the main thing that what happened in Japan may have done is at some level concentrate our minds a little bit about the need to start making progress. I wrote a piece for The Guardian right the next week saying the main thing that it sort of struck me about the whole thing was just a reminder of what a narrow margin civilization actually exists on. Now, that was a natural disaster that happened in Japan, an earthquake and a tsunami, but it knocked, you know, it clearly knocked a large part of that highly civilized society over the edge very, very fast. We're reducing constantly that margin by changing the climate. We're taking that margin all the time and eroding it. And that should be, in some ways, the main lesson of Japan. And I think it probably should remind us that going forward, we do well to spend less time worrying about growth all the time and things, and more time worrying about durability and resilience and safety and security and all those sort of things as well. It was a pretty instructive moment, and I think it'll be very interesting to see how the Japanese interpret that experience.
This year there will be 7 billion people on the earth, and so the need for more food, more transportation, and so on. How can that work?
The question's about population and about the fact that we're going past 7 billion people. So one can talk about population in several different ways. I wrote a book years ago called Maybe One, a kind of argument for single-child families in the West. So population is something I've spent a lot of time thinking about. It's very important. But at this point, one can talk about it in many ways as a great success story, too, for human beings. 30 years ago, the average woman on this planet had 6 children. That number now is 2.6 and continuing to fall very fast. The demographers say we're going to go from 7 billion now to about 9 billion at the middle of the century, and then our human population will plateau and begin to drop. It's not going to double again or anywhere close to it. And the reason for that is that people got their act together. We figured out, not we so much, people in the developing world figured out what it would take to slow down their birth rates. And what it took, to some degree, was the availability of contraception and things, but much more importantly, what it took was the education and the relative empowerment of women. And when that happened, in place after place after place, fertility, family size dropped dramatically. Now, you know, 9 billion will be harder to deal with than 7, but most of that growth is coming in places that use so little energy that it's not the driver of climate change. And we forget just how vast that gulf is. The average North American family uses more energy between stroke of midnight on New Year's Eve and dinner on January 2nd than the average Tanzanian family uses in the course of a year. Okay? So the number of Tanzanians is not a significant variable when we're talking about climate change. Most of the increase right now in global warming gases, though in per capita terms they're nowhere near us, but most of the increase is coming in places like China with stable populations, but where consumption is rising towards a North American mean, you know? And it's figuring out how to alter that consumption curve now that's as important as altering the fertility curve a generation ago. We don't know quite what to do, how to do it. The hope is that putting a real price on carbon might have some of the same educational effects that putting women in school did in much of the world.
Are these 350 demonstrations and photo ops enough to save us from the worst of climate change? Bill McKibben asked and answered.
Can you speak to the role of civil disobedience in this movement?
Yes, I could. We're going to need more of it, I'm afraid. Because the question was, can I speak to the role of civil disobedience in this movement? And look, we need ways to illustrate the moral urgency of the situation that we're in. And one of the ways we do that is you know, through the set of tactics that Gandhi and Martin Luther King and others taught us over the last century, one of the great inventions in many ways of the last century. In their way, I think, will be of longer value and more interest than the other inventions like cracking the atom or whatever of the last century. Now, that said, it's very hard to, you know, civil disobedience is a double-edged sword and it's easy for it to cause more trouble than help. If we're going to do it, well, I'll tell a story I told yesterday. I organized 2 years ago, just about 2 years ago this month, the first big civil disobedience thing in the U.S. on climate. And we did it, we almost couldn't help but do it because the U.S. Congress, it turns out, has its own power plant. Two blocks away from the beautiful Capitol is this incredibly grimy, hulking old thing that's been there for 115 years burning coal. And we thought it should not be burning coal. And so a few of us, the great American writer, my favorite American writer of all, Wendell Berry, the wonderful farmer essayist, he and I sent out a letter and said, come to Washington, we were going to sit in outside this power plant and try to get it closed down. And it, since we didn't have any real idea what we were doing, it worked somewhat better than really it should have. We had thought that 500 people would come until we'd reached an agreement with the police that they would arrest 500 people and it would all be... But 5,000 people came. And so the police said, we can't arrest anybody. We don't have that many cells. But it didn't matter because Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid, who run the House, who ran in those days the House and the Senate, said, okay, we'll shift it off coal. And so it's, you know, one down, 600 to go. The key thing, and here's the point I want to make about civil disobedience. We were thinking hard as we did this how not to give the usual picture, which is, you know, a bunch of kind of raggedy folks angry at everything and looking threatening and kind of nutty and whatever else. We said, if you want to come to this, you only can come. We don't allow you to come unless you're wearing your Sunday best. So if you're not in a dress or in a necktie, we don't want to see you. And the reason was that we wanted to get across the point visually, as well as anything else, that we're not the radicals in this scenario. There's nothing radical about what I'm told you tonight. Just the opposite. The radical proposition is, let's pour a lot of carbon into the atmosphere until the atmospheric composition that's worked for the last 10,000 years is completely shifted and just see what happens. That's crazy, okay? That's radical at the most root level. If there was ever, no one ever thought, if the Soviet Union had been doing that secretly, if they'd had like secret carbon dioxide factories, we would have bombed the hell out of them, you know? That's completely radical. we needed a way to say, in this instance, really, we're kind of the conservatives, you know. We're trying to preserve the Earth in something like the form in which we found it, a basic conservative task. So I think that as we do civil disobedience, that, and one of the ways that we're going to try to do that, I hope if we do more of it, and we will be doing more of it at least in the States, is make sure that if we do civil disobedience this time, it is not college kids who are the only cannon fodder for this project, okay? It's not fair because A, they still have, you know, resumes to fill out and jobs to get, and B, because they haven't been pouring carbon into the atmosphere for 50, 60, 70 years like some of us, you know? I told a story this morning to someone about the first time I got arrested on this. It was the first climate sort of civil disobedience of any kind in the U.S. And it was some years ago, and there was a wonderful woman, a 90-year-old woman. She walked across the United States when she was 90, 5 miles at a time as a protest about this stuff. And she was going 5 miles at a time because she had emphysema and because she was 90 years old, okay? 3 years later, she was on the cover of Time, so she was very effective. But 3 years later, she called me up, said, come to Washington, we're having a protest. And you know, I knew it was not going to change the world, this protest. But when someone who's 93 tells me to do something, I generally do it, you know. And so I went, and we held a little sign, stop global warming, stop campaign contributions from global warmers. And we held it in the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol. And that's too close, apparently, because they arrested us. And they handcuffed the two of us together. And it was very funny because she was like 4'8", okay? And so I'm like this, you know? And she looks up at me in her emphysema voice. She said, you know, she said, I'm 93, never been arrested before, should have started long ago. So I was like, I don't know if you all need to get arrested, all right? But that's the kind of spirit that we require if we're going to get anywhere on this. Good question.
Yeah, speaking of getting anywhere, if the money of the oil industry wins the day, do you see any hope for all the various plan Bs that are out there, like sequestering, you know, geoengineering in general?
So are there kind of fallback plans like sequestering carbon beneath the, or geoengineering the planet? There are scientists talking about how we might do this stuff, but it's all so far in the realm of science fiction, and it all comes with enormous drawbacks. So maybe we could, having filled the atmosphere with carbon and increased the temperature, the most common sort of fallback plan that some scientists are envisioning is maybe we could also fill the atmosphere with enough sulfur to block incoming solar radiation. Okay, and it might, you can sort of do the math where it might work if you kind of constantly fly this stream of jets up into the atmosphere and dump sulfur, if you fire artillery shells all the time with sulfur into the atmosphere. But A, you know, the sky turns a nice milky white. B, you've got sort of acid rain falling. C, the ocean is still turning to acid anyway. D, to the extent that we can even model these kind of things on computers, it looks like these side effects are almost as bad as the disease. Like potentially or quite likely you manage to move the monsoon off off the Asian subcontinent. At which point, you know, I mean, there's only 2 billion people or so who depend on it for dinner. These are break-the-glass solutions, okay? We might do well to research some of them in case everything goes kaflooey, but I used to run a homeless shelter, so I spent a lot of time with junkies. This is the kind of logic that junkies bring to problems, okay? And we'd probably be smart to try and, like, deal with the underlying cause, would be my guess.
Here's the concluding answer from Bill with a question about the role of industrial agriculture.
And the final question just about agriculture in general. Look, Monsanto and all the other big agricultural players, the only way that we're going to deal with those kind, I mean, the reason that we have industrial agriculture on the scale that we do is because we have cheap fossil fuel. The only way that we will really change our agricultural systems or many of our other systems on a large scale is by putting a price on fossil fuel to make it reflect the damage that it does in the atmosphere. When that happens, that's the day that we will see a begin of a real decline in industrial agriculture and a real and deep and powerful resurgence in the kind of local and highly productive agriculture that holds some hope for feeding a world that's dealing with these kind of problems. So I thank you all enormously for bearing with me.
That's what we have from Bill McKibben, the founder of 350.org. Don't forget to plan your speak out for the coming worldwide demo on September 24th, 2011. The theme is motion without fossil fuels. To record this speech with good audio quality, I have to thank Mark Van Driel of webeventcast.com. Mark has amazing technology that can do a live webcast, complete with the speaker, slides, and audience participation, and then post it just minutes later with no wait for editing. I was blown away by the possibilities for live participation right on the internet. Find him at webeventcast.com. And my thanks to the Vancouver Institute, which continues to bring important speakers to the city, open to the public for free. You can't beat that. Fukushima? Still important. Still leaking radioactivity all over the world. I'll be doing more investigative reporting on the Japanese nuclear accident in coming Radio EcoShock shows. Climate change? The real big deal. Let's not forget as we drive around and waste the last of the fossil fuels buying plastic junk from a world away. We have to keep active on climate change, like the future of the world and our grandchildren really matter. Otherwise, we don't really matter, except to be known as the generation who wrecked nature when we could have made the big change toward climate justice and clean energy in our homes, our industries, our countries, our world. I know you want to. Let's do it together. I'm Alex Smith. Find our interviews with climate scientists and activists, plus intense coverage of the Fukushima nuclear accident at our website, ecoshock.org. And be sure and click the podcast button to make sure you don't miss our periodic Japan atomic emergency updates and all our shows. By the way, watch out for a lot of crazy fear-mongering on the net. One example is a series of YouTube videos by Dutch Incense and Patriot Space. These supposedly show radiation being dumped on the west coast of North America in big quantities, unreported by the media. I contacted the original scientist, Dr. John F. Burkhardt, in Norway. In his email reply to me, Dr. Burkhardt says his work has been totally misrepresented, used for fear-mongering. He tried to contact Dutch Incense and his companion, but there was no way to get them and correct the revelations. In fact, what these models were meant to show, and it says this right on the main page if anyone looks, is the worst-case scenario that could happen, like an atomic blow-up at Fukushima or something. These models would have meant something if Fukushima emissions remained at their initial levels when the hydrogen explosions took place, but that didn't happen either. Emissions have dropped significantly in the month that followed. The models shown in the video by Dutch Incense do not reflect actual radiation hitting the West Coast or anywhere else. Worse, Dutch Incense then shows a new, even worse projection of xenon 133. It looks like a big, ominous dark blue across the whole northern hemisphere. What Dutch Incense did not realize or did not tell his viewers is that projection was using a completely different scale. In order to see where xenon 133 might have gone, Burkhardt multiplied the slight impressions of his previous model to be able to see where the wind and weather might have taken xenon 133. It's actually the same projection as the previous one, but multiplied a lot. Dutch Incense and Patriot Space have yet another video out where they ponder the meaning of some straight lines across the globe on another Burkhardt file. These are, in Burkhardt's words, garbage, a run that did not work, a screenshot sent to a colleague to figure out why the model was not working. All our genii had to do was to contact the scientist and ask what the models were meant to show, or look at the main page on the website, maybe. Next week, I'll be looking into the facts and the strange fantasy and conspiracy theories about the Fukushima nuclear disaster. Radio EcoShock.